Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk and dissect and review work life in the networking industry. This week, the virtual workbench is instantiated in downtown San Jose at Cisco's headquarters. We've got a good view of the cloud. It's a little bit frosty today, maybe. A little bit sunny, so maybe not as many clouds as usual, but we're going to gather in the virtual meeting room that holds Victor Marino and his encyclopedic knowledge of Lisp. But before we go there, I just want to do the usual begging that we do at the beginning of the show. As you know, Packet Pushers is looking for sponsors and donations, and we, as the show's getting bigger and bigger, it's taking more time to run the whole show as a hobby. So we'd like to get your help. There's a few things you can do for us. If you're a listener, there's three things. Tell other people about us. As the numbers grow, it gets easier for me to convince advertisers that it's worth sponsoring us. It's also easier to get big names and big companies to join in the fun. Tell everyone, leave a review, blog about the show, talk about us at conferences, spam Google Plus, all you like, whatever you can. Secondly, there's a donation button at packetpushers.net. If you can flip the team some coffee money to say thanks, well, that would be awesome too. I'd also like to particularly thank those who've already donated. It's just marvelous how much money some people have done. And I am starting to send emails back to say thank you. And I am truly grateful for your support. And finally, subscribe to the mailing list at the Packet Pushers website so that we can contact you with updates about the show and also let you know where we have special events such as partnering with vendors for webinars to talk about things. We've also got some plans coming up soon to revisit the design clinics. We've got some video recording stuff nearly finished. You can find the sign-up bar for the form in the sidebar. Joining us this week, as always, is Ethan Banks. What's been happening with you?
Man, I feel like I got the same story to report every week, but it's firewalls, more firewalls. I got two that I shipped out to a site. I got another one in the queue, and I'm working on a failover design that's going to involve those firewalls to some degree. So that has been my world. That, and I did get back from another amazing hike up in the White Mountains in New Hampshire. 3 days, and by the time I hiked out of the woods on that third day, man, I was done, fully baked. But I put some great pictures up on Google Plus, and it was a good time, a nice time to de-nerd a bit, you know?
You got the de-nerding wand out, waved it over yourself?
Absolutely.
Yeah, de-stressed. And Google Plus has been sucking up your time, just like me?
I like it better than Facebook for, you know, I think XKCD kind of had the best comic. It's Facebook, but it isn't. And that kind of sums it up in a way.
I agree. And also joining us this week is Victor Moreno from Cisco. How are you, Victor? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Doing great, Craig. Thanks for having me. We're busy ramping up to Cisco Live next week right now. So there's a lot of exciting stuff happening a lot of it is around the areas of Lisp and virtualization and cloud. And that's basically what I've been doing at Cisco for a few years now. I work at Cisco in the capacity of product manager / technical lead within the data center business unit. And some of the projects that are in my purview include Lisp, OTV, Fabric Path. So all of which we're trying to combine to actually get a good, solid feature set in support of all the requirements in the evolve.
Yeah, cool. So OTV is a technology we've talked about, I think not specifically on any previous shows, but it's starting to feel a little bit old hat to me in some ways, but that might just be me. So I thought what we should do is talk today about Lisp. So Lisp is the location-independent separation protocol. Did I get the S right?
Almost. So it's the location and identity separation protocol, which leads to location independence. So you were in the right path.
Nice save.
I love it when guests are nice to me. That makes me feel less stupid than I actually am. All right, well, perhaps the best place to start with Lisp is if you give us the elevator pitch. Tell us a little bit about what Lisp is, why it came about.
Okay, so an identity separation isn't really an old idea. It's been around the industry for a long time, and the original driver behind Lisp was basically the challenge of scaling routing tables in the internet routers. Basically, we're well north of 300,000 prefixes, touching on 400,000. And all of these prefixes are distributed in such a way that they cannot be properly aggregated in the internet core routers. And basically that creates a large challenge in terms of scaling those big routers. So one of the things that we thought about was basically what creates that problem is the fact that addresses are representative not only of the identity of the end to reach, but also of their location, right? And the fact that these two things are bundled together makes the aggregation of prefixes very, very difficult, right? So by separating the addressing into two spaces, a space that represents who the endpoints are, and we call that the endpoint identifier space, and a separate space that represents the location of those endpoints, and we call that the routing locator space. By making that separation, we're able to actually bring back aggregability into the network. Now, that was the core driver behind Lisp, was basically this goal of scaling the internet in a systematic way. Mm. Now, what we found while doing this whole process is that not only does it give us scale these routing tables, but it also gives us the ability to actually provide seamless mobility at a very broad scale, which is something we haven't been able to do so far in networking. So I think when I'm asked for the definition of Lisp, usually what comes to mind is we've added to our routing architecture a very intelligent way of handling our addressing space. So it's basically an incremental enhancement to the existing routing infrastructure that allows us to now decouple the addresses from their location semantics. So we continue to route based on location, and we simplified our routing by simply having one endpoint reach another, meaning one router can reach another router, and those are all low. Now, the part that's very variable is whoever's connecting to that network, right? And if you think of it in the realm of a data center, for example, if you have a set of virtual machines that could be connecting to one switch to connect to a different switch, you will see how being able to decouple the addresses of those virtual machines from the actual addresses of the routers that they're connecting to allows you to now move things around very easily without churning your routing protocol.
If what I'm hearing is correct, Lisp actually creates a separation between the network as a routable address range and the endpoint, which is a host ID. And you can then take the endpoint or the host address, and it's not physically attached to the network. It can be logically separated and routed independently. Is that in some way what Lisp does?
That is exactly what Lisp does. Basically, it provides a mechanism to create a mapping between the routable prefixes that are the network prefixes, which we call the routing locators, and the endpoint identifiers that are the prefixes that identify the hosts that are connecting to that network. So by creating that mapping, we simply leverage the routed infrastructure and basically determine where a specific host may be attaching at any given point in time. As hosts move around the infrastructure, the mappings will be updated, but the routing that happens in the core remains unaltered, right? So it's still IPv4 or IPv6 routing. This is totally independent of the address family, right? So in the core, you still use OSPF, BGP, whatever it is that you're using for routing there, and you get a very stable scenario, because now the entropy that was originally introduced by different subnets in different places and actually taking pieces of those subnets and moving them onto different locations, that entropy is totally removed from all the routing tables in that core, right? So so that entropy is handled by the mapping system at this point. So you've removed that into an out-of-band, if you may, mapping system. That mapping, basically, which is held outside of the network infrastructure, allows us to abstract all that complexity of different locations and different address positioning from the network itself.
Right. So if I look at the Lisp standard, it talks about I'm looking at the Lisp overview page. So for the listeners, there's a web page called lisp.cisco.com, which has a very succinct 500-word overview of what Lisp is. And it talks about this concept of an RLOC and an EID. Maybe you could explain the difference between an RLOC and an endpoint identifier.
Right. So the RLOC stands for Routing Locator, and that is basically the addresses of the network devices. So the routers, basically the router interfaces that you have throughout your core are going to be your RLOCs, right? Those are basically one address space. The other address space is the endpoint identifier address space, and those are basically the prefixes that are at the periphery of that core. And those are normally the prefixes where you will have your hosts exist. So your laptop, your mobile phone, your virtual machines in your data center, all of those devices will be in an endpoint identifier prefix space, right? And then they will basically reach each other by virtue of mapping those endpoint identifiers to a specific RLOC where you can reach it. So, for example, if I have two locations, location A and location B, and I want to get traffic to an endpoint identifier that is in location B, what I'm going to do is I'm going to find through the Lisp mapping system, I'm going to find that those EIDs that I'm trying to get to are indeed in location B. So I'm going to send all my traffic to the RLOCs that get me to location B. So those are the IP addresses of the interfaces on the routers that get me to location B. Right. So if I move to a third location, location C, to reach mm-hmm. the same EID, all I do is now I send the traffic to the RLOCs that are the IP addresses of the location C routers. Right, so you can see how this is actually giving us a degree of mobility that we didn't quite have before, because in the RLOC space, nothing has really changed. A, B, and C know how to get to each other regardless of which EID attach where, right? And then the different EID to RLOC mappings will actually be updated as the network changes.
Right. So if an EID moves from location A to location B, then there has to be a tunnel, because the traffic's going to have to be encapsulated and to get to location B. So it's going to flow. Right. The DNS is still going to point to the original network IP address, and then router A is then going to tunnel it across to router B. Is that?
That's correct. So basically Lisp provides a map and endcap type mechanism. And if you think of a packet flow, a complete packet flow, what happens first is we say we want to get to a destination, and that destination is abc.com, their web server. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we do is we go and consult with the DNS server and get an IP address for abc.com. So we resolve that name, and that will give us an IP address. And that IP address is an endpoint identifier, right? It's the identity of that very endpoint that we want to get to. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do at that point, we use regular routing to get to a device that's a Lisp-enabled device. So say you're doing this from a branch in your company, your default routing is going to take you to the branch router, right? Yeah. At the branch router, you're going to basically have this branch router look up this destination, and it's actually not going to be in the routing table for that branch router. The branch router is going to basically do a Lisp lookup.
Yep.
And he's going to find a mapping for that. At that point, the mapping is going to tell us which RLock we can use to get to the location where that EAD actually is. Right? So that's where we do the encapsulation that you were mentioning. We basically do the lookup for the mapping, and we encapsulate to that mapping. So we're really encapsulating IP in IP. So we add an IP, an extra IP header to this so that we can actually make the traffic go to the location that we want it to go.
The natural question then is how much overhead is introduced by the tunnel?
A great question. So the overhead introduced by the tunnel, I believe it's 64 bytes at this point. I could be wrong on that. But in any case, there is an overhead, and it does create the concerns that we have with MTU sizes in the core and so forth. Now, an interesting thing with Lisp is that it is indeed an IP hop. If you look at layer 2 VPN solutions, they don't present an IP hop, and therefore we can't use ICMP to signal back to the host to throttle back their MTU sizes. Lisp is indeed an IP hop, and we could actually do the MTU throttling when necessary. Now, that's not foolproof because many applications don't take those messages or don't actually honor those messages. Mm-hmm. So what we need really is a little more headroom in the MTU space in the core, which is not rare to find, but it could be an issue in some cases.
Well, it would be if it was internet. So your primary, the primary point I've seen with Lisp is it allows you to have a site redundancy possibility where you can actually migrate a system that was previously at site A to site B and then tell the internet that it's there. But you're also relying on the internet to have an MTU that allows for the oversized packets, which it doesn't normally have.
Right, right. So we have two options. It's either adjusted inside the site or the core actually caters for the larger MTU with the 64-byte overhead. Now, that's an interesting point you bring up about the multi-homing, because that is one of the benefits that we get when we use something like Lisp, right? The fact that we have separated the RLock addresses from the endpoint addresses means that I no longer need to be coordinated with my WAN provider. Say I have connectivity to two different WAN clouds from two different providers. I don't necessarily have to have coordination of the addresses that I use when I use one provider versus another. I can take my addresses and actually leverage services from many providers. Since I'm not distributing my routes into their provider equipment, I can now basically independently go over the top of all these different providers. And that includes, of course, the internet, provided that we can actually cater for the right MTU settings with the traffic that we're actually sending over this.
Then there's a traffic engineering advantage there, as I recall, in that you don't, if you want to do equal cost load balancing, it gets a little easier to do that with Lisp.
Correct. Correct. So if I have connectivity to a couple of these clouds, and I wanted to do ingress traffic engineering today, I would have to basically do a lot of BGP pirouettes and work with a lot of parameters there that would have to be agreed upon between my site and the different providers that I'm working with. With Lisp, I decide what kind of weights and priorities I give to each link to receive traffic. And that's a policy that is solely defined at the customer edge device. So it's a lot easier, both organizationally as well as technically, to actually set the distribution of loads across different links and different services when you're using Lisp to actually multi-home to different services. So that's another big item there that actually makes Lisp interesting. So you have basically a combination of different benefits when you look at Lisp, right? So we talked a little bit about the ability to move prefixes around and not have to readdress when you move from one provider to another, or when you actually take a virtual machine and move it from one data center to another. You can preserve the same IP address. The only thing that changes is the mappings that you have, but your routing doesn't get affected. We talked a little bit about the ability to multi-home onto different providers and do that in a seamless way. And with that multi-homing comes the advantage of being able to define the different traffic engineering policies that we can actually put in place very simply when we are multi-homed and actually prefer one service versus another.
Okay, so the balance. So if I can imagine a situation where we're doing now, so what we're saying is that, you know, you could loop to site A and then to site B, and then site B could divert you onto site C. Is there a mechanism to prevent that?
So the reachability in Lisp is always, we like to call it single hop or stretch one, right? So as you change locations and move machines from one place to another, the mapping system is updated, but also the caches in the different places are updated so that you're always sending your traffic directly to the RLOC that is at the site where your target is, right? Where your endpoint is. So you basically, what Lisp is doing is allowing you to avoid that hopping across sites. So if you look at a solution like IP mobility, for example, or mobile IP, be it V4 or V6, yeah. There's this concept of a home agent that is at the home site of the device that's moving. By the time you hit that home site, you're already in the wrong place, and then you get punted to the right place.
Regardless of the destination point. Yeah.
Exactly.
Quite frankly, mobile IP should come back. Then we'd all be happy. But we wouldn't have any of this layer 2 nonsense going on.
Right.
I actually got it working. Worked on a site where we actually had it working. Right. We had a mobile IPv4 client, and you could actually be in the office, and then when you walked out of the office, it would roam onto 3G, and then when you came off a 3G network to your home wireless, it would then actually the mobile IP, and then when you walked, you know, as you moved from site to site, the mobile your IP address never changed.
But right, and that's one of the things that you achieve with Lisp. The multi-homing that we're talking about could be done over different networks, right? It could be done over 3G. You could be connected to 3G and Wi-Fi at the same time, and have a policy to balance the load across that. You could also have a policy that weans you off one network onto another, depending on the power that you have there. So we're looking at a lot of applications in the transportation industry where this becomes of much interest. In using Lisp.
So that's a unique feature of Lisp. Is what you're saying is you can almost apply policy to it and say, not only are you able to mobile, you know, move the IP address from point A to point B to point C and have a central point redirect you to wherever you are now.
Right.
You can also say, and when you go to that site, actually load balance it across these various links. You can actually attach some sort of policy to it.
Correct.
And which is heading towards the orchestration or software defined.
Exactly. I was going to say exactly what you just mentioned. That is basically that policy is controlled mainly by the endpoints, but is also registered to a central repository that has communication with all the endpoints. So there is a clear linkage that can be established between the mapping database in the Lisp system and any orchestration type system that we have that keeps control of different elements. So, for example, if you have a vCenter in the data center space, you would actually be able to have vCenter communicate directly with the Lisp mapping database, and that causes synergies that allow you to basically get optimal mobility and optimal information flow in both directions, right? So the orchestrators may benefit from knowing about location in the network and network attributes, but also based on the orchestrator's policy, we could actually influence how we do our traffic engineering onto our endpoints.
Now, is that something you're saying vCenter is going to be able to do, or is that a hypothetical? Wouldn't it be nice if it could do that?
At this point, it's a hypothetical, the same type of conversation is something that we have with people developing network controllers in the OpenFlow space. I think a balance where we go with this is we reach a balance onto what's actually controlled by the network control plane and what's actually controlled by the orchestrators or network controllers. And when we strike the right balance there, that's when we actually get the optimal cloud recipe in the network. So that's work in progress.
That's not surprising because orchestration's still new.
Correct.
In terms of networking years, you know, TCP/IP is 30 years old, and it's taken us 30 years to get Lisp going. In terms of developing software platforms that can dynamically divert traffic in 14 different directions at once, is going to take a while to come about. It's not going to happen, you know, even with all the blah, blah cloud stuff that's happening at the moment.
Right, and that's where we take one step at a time. But I think architecturally, it's one of the things that has looked the most promising in the last few years in terms of being able to somewhat centralize the information that we have on the network, yet maintain the task of forwarding distributed and maintain what routing does well in the routing realm, yet take all those things that routing didn't quite handle best natively, and taking those somewhat out of the network and into the Lisp control plane. Right. So if you look at the history of things that we've added onto our IP stack or our IP routing protocols, better said, we see mobility, we see the creation of VPNs, we see all the these traffic engineering policies, all these routing policies to be able to do multi-homing. If you take all of that and you provide a systematic way to actually solve all these problems with one solution rather than having three or four different protocols stacked on top of each other, that's a lot of what Lisp is actually providing us. Right? So since we do a MAP and NCAP, we have the ability to actually add VPN semantics to these encapsulations as well as to the control plane. So one of the things that Lisp does well is also allows you to interconnect VRFs across these different edge devices, right? So you have a mobility solution that has also the hooks in place to create VPNs. And to create VPNs in a manner that's very scalable, right? And the scalability derives from the fact that Lisp is not using a push mechanism to send the information on reachability everywhere, but the information on reachability is only cached upon request. So as we explained the packet flow earlier, once you've got your DNS resolved, you got to resolve your Lisp, and only then are you going to cache the mapping. But otherwise, if you don't need to get to a certain destination, you're not going to cache that information.
Right. Not every Lisp router out there needs to know about every possible destination he could get to.
Exactly. It only needs to know about those destinations that it needs to talk to, right? So when you take that to the VRF type environment where you have multiple routing tables, you can see how if you have a mechanism that pulls the information on request rather than having it pushed onto it, if you have a multitude of VRFs, clearly the push mechanism will actually cease to scale rather rapidly as you increase the number of VRFs. However, the pull mechanism has a little more headroom to actually grow.
It's a better scale.
Better
because,
scale, yeah.
Because you're actually relying on the edge device to hold the state, not a core device, customers who supply the edge device, or the people who supply it, there are more edge devices than there are core devices, so it's easier to scale that feature of it.
Exactly. and the state is distributed, right? So the further this gets pushed to the edges of the network, the better scale characteristics you achieve, and the more optimality you get in your paths and choices of routes, etc.
So it's definitely an alternative to using BGP and advertising routes to dual home ISPs. You don't need to do that because Lisp would solve that problem for you.
Correct.
And the only thing that needs to speak Lisp is your routers. So if I had two, let's say I had three data centers, it's only my three routers that need to speak Lisp to each other.
Right, right. We have a running joke at Cisco where we say that our motto is that the only way is the overlay. And that's not Cisco's official stance by any means, but there's our group of people who works on Lisp, and Lisp is an overlay solution, right? And as such, it only needs to be enabled on the devices that are at the if it's customer driven, it can be the customer premises alone.
It sounds like structural duct tape. You know how we've called the duct tape of the internet, and we've been using exactly. Tunnels and then we turned them into IPsec tunnels, and then we turned them, this is actually saying like, okay, we give in. Tunnels are actually the only way we're ever going to make this work, so we're going to make them structural. Forget everything we've taught you for the last 20 years about don't use tunnels. It's all done. We're going to use them, right?
And of course, we're going to argue that that these aren't strictly speaking tunnels because we don't maintain any pinned up connections between the two RLOCs, right? But you do a lookup and you put it really on a forwarding table where you do an encapsulation at forwarding time, rather than having a tunnel where we're actually maintaining keeping track of the state of the other endpoint and establishing. Just to give an example, in the security area, security association type of relationship, we don't maintain that kind of state, right? But still, it's an encap, which you could simplify as a tunnel conceptually. Yeah.
But you wouldn't necessarily. I've spoken a couple of times about doing it as an internet facing thing because that's just what's in the top of my tiny little brain. But VM mobility remains the same as well. You could actually have a given IP address migrating its way around and just run Lisp in the data center alone behind
Correct.
The firewall.
Correct.
And as machines provided, you had a way of notifying the Lisp systems. So would that mean that the NX1000 can be a Lisp device?
Okay, so you hit a very important point here. So we have what we see in terms of trends and adoption is we foresee that customers are going to have private Lisp deployments before anything else, meaning they can do that in their private network within their data centers. Now, that's one important point. You could go over the internet. You could go inside your data center. Initially, you can actually manage all the different Lisp roles that need to be in the infrastructure, meaning you will manage the routers that encap and decap. You will also manage the routers that talk to non-Lisp sites, which we call proxy routers. Mm-hmm. And you will potentially manage also your own mapping database. Moving forward, what we expect to see is the evolution of an ecosystem of providers that offer things like, is it mandatory that you subscribe to one of these? No. Is it convenient? It may prove to be very convenient at some point. So expect to see a lot of these ecosystem players actually coming public over the course of the next two quarters or so. Now, that's one area that I wanted to provide clarity to you because you made the comment, right? Now, you also asked about how we actually detect moves in the data center and if we need to have anything special on the servers. So the short answer is no, you don't need anything special on the servers. We will automatically detect the move of any server based on activity coming from the server. So what we do today is when we receive a packet from a server, we will look at the source IP address, kind of a URPF check, right? And if that source is not in my subnet, that sets off an alarm and says, okay, there's something here. Normally, all you would do is URPF failed, drop the packet, and keep on going with life. Now, when it's a Lisp-enabled router, you say URPF failed. Okay, this might be a move. So let me compare this with the range of prefixes that are allowed to move onto this location. And if there's a match, then at that point, we're going to say that this is actually a move.
Right. Now, you're saying that he detects that system has moved just by virtue of there being a packet on the wire with that source IP address.
Correct.
As opposed to a notification mechanism that says, like from the VM infrastructure, saying, hey, this is moving, or I'm moving it.
Correct. And the reason we do that today is because we have very many different flavors of virtual machines that are out on the market, and this would be the totally transparent mechanism of actually doing the detection. Now, that has, of course, certain limitations based on some servers being unidirectional servers and things of that nature. But in general, this covers the vast majority of the deployment scenarios. For those corner cases...
So we do it at the network layer. The servers guys don't have to know about it or have to detect it or have to configure anything. We can just do it without them knowing. And that's yeah. Whereas if we integrate with them, we get advantages like faster response times and signaling from the server, but the server operating system needs to be signaling to the routers that it's moved, and then we have to create agents and servers, and then they have to be HA'd, and that becomes almost an insurmountable challenge.
Right. Then we're back to the organizational challenge of coordinating all of this and making everybody get on the same page. With the current mechanism of just recognizing a move based on data plane events, basically what we're saying is that as the server administrator could have an environment where we've provided layer 2 extensions and they move within that, or they could have Lisp mechanisms actually doing this detection for them, and they move within that, and they don't know the difference between one and another, nor do they need to know, because they're not administrating the network. It's the network managers that are actually aware of, do they use Lisp, or are they using extending layer 2 across the board to actually achieve these moves. It keeps things independent and transparent. Now, you're absolutely right. If we had signaling from the servers, you could, for example, pre-converge a move. So if we know that something is going to move, we could have the mapping servers and everything be pre-converged. So by the time the move completes and we get a signal from vCenter, for example, we could then flip the switch, and then you say, okay, from this moment on, all these policies that we preloaded are effective. So it's kind of like a fast reroute at that point. So those are the kinds of optimizations that you could potentially see. And the Nexus 1000V is in a position that could actually get to that level because of the coordination between the vCenter information and the information on the Nexus 1000V.
Yeah, right. So it could.
It could, yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
In theory. For now, we have a product on our infrastructure switches, right, that does the detection as explained, looking at source addresses and so forth. But and we have a prototype of the functionality also working on the Nexus 1000V. But you know, it will take the industry to come to an agreement. Okay, here's how we signal between a hypervisor and the network, right? That needs to be standardized. Otherwise, it's going to be one flavor for one hypervisor type and a different flavor for yet another, and so forth. Right.
I'm getting VMware and Citrix with their Xen and, you know, all those different people to come together and converge, and then get, you know, that written into the kernel of those hypervisors is not going to be something that's going to happen quickly when they're busy delivering functionality elsewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. There's other priorities. There's also market interests. So so we've tried to actually fit the solution to the current environment. And yes, we keep working on potential enhancements. But for now, it's totally transparent.
Yeah, which is probably the better ways to get off the ground, and then later on it can develop into something else. A while ago, I was reading an RFC. To my mind, Lisp isn't actually a standard as yet. It's been submitted as a draft proposal to the IETF. Is that correct, Victor?
So Lisp is basically a what we call an experimental work group, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a standards track work group. As far as the documents themselves, they have been, actually as of last week, they have been subject to what we call last call, which basically takes the drafts and allows the work group to actually say and put in any last feedback before this actually goes to the editor and becomes an RFC. The RFCs that come out of the work group will be experimental RFCs, but there'll be RFCs nonetheless, right? These are agreed upon documents where anybody participating in the work group would have had their say on what they think should be done there or should not be done there, right? So from that perspective, they are RFCs. Now, is it a standards track work group? It isn't right now, and the reason is it's impactful enough that we wanted an environment where we could actually eventually make changes, right? So the experimental group allows us to do that. If we were to pursue a standards track, which we will eventually, but if we were to pursue that immediately, there would be no space for lessons learned. It would have to be, the moment it becomes an RFC, a final standard. So the experimental group allows us to reach the milestone of getting to an agreement and a consensus with what everybody knows at this point in time. Mm-hmm. That will generate implementations. We will learn from the industry, and you never know. Maybe we got 90% of it right, and the changes when we go into standards track will be minimal. But it could actually be more than that. But in any
case, so let me rephrase that. Yep. So what you're saying is you've produced the drafts, you've asked anybody who wants to take an interest to come and participate into those documents. Those drafts have been published. They've now gone to final call, which is anybody else who's got something to say, speak now or forever hold your peace. Right. And then effectively you've announced the engagement. And Lisp will be then out there for anybody to implement. And you're effectively hoping that not only Cisco but other vendors and indeed the hypervisor vendors or a range of other companies will pick it up and start to look at deploying that into their software or evaluating or opening up the participation at an experimental level. Because the RFC is experimental, it can be changed. So if there's any more lessons to be learned from real-life deployments or early-stage deployments or opening it up to more people, then you can reflect those into another phase of drafts, which then turn into a standards track.
That's the first summary. And on the front of adoption, we have a couple of startups in Japan that have implementations. There's about 6 or 7 open source implementations of Lisp out there. And there are some serious networking companies that are actively evaluating this. I'll let them make the announcements when their time is right.
Now, if I'm in a Cisco shop and I have the appropriate equipment to run Lisp, what are the risks to me? That this is really a listener question that came through, and it's an appropriate time to ask it. I mean, you use it in the context of the how far along the RFC has gotten. You said experimental, which I'm sure is going to throw some people. Is this a particularly risky thing to implement? Are there serious caveats that people should be considering if they're looking at putting Lisp out there, either out their internet edge or in their enterprise between data centers?
So the experimental nature of the RFCs doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to change overnight or anything like that. It really helps us get to consensus on an RFC a lot faster because of the perceived flexibility. But the reality is once we put the RFC down, that's what it is. Now, when we look at the product development, right, there's encapsulation headers and things that need to be decided very early on for us to actually get this in the hardware, etc. So don't expect that to change anytime soon. It's going to take a long time before anything changes substantially in Lisp data plane type stuff. We will probably make the control plane richer, but the intent is to actually stay with the data plane the way it is, right?
So does it make sense if I'm an enterprise Cisco customer looking at Lisp? Does it make sense for me to get serious about trying to deploy this at this point? Or would it be, you know, not something I'd want to bet the data center on?
Actually, we are giving you the tools to actually get serious about Lisp right now. We have mainline releases on ISRs, or the whole range of ISRs on ASR 1000, and in the month of July, you should see a mainline release on the Nexus 7000. So those are the first mainline releases. Now, keep in mind that we have run a Lisp pilot network for the last 3.5 years. That network today is basically over 120 nodes in 20-something countries across all continents. So we have actually been testing and hammering Lisp for a very long time now. So Lisp has been developed in a very unique way at Cisco. We ran this experimental network. The development was done basically in a small startup-like group within Cisco, and we've basically done things in a slightly different way. So expect it to be rock solid at day one. And what we've designed is basically targeted towards the use of it in production. So we stand behind Lisp 100%, and we do encourage people to actually go ahead and deploy Lisp. We have references and a lot of design guidance. There's a ton of expertise, not only within Cisco, but also outside of Cisco, given the size of that pilot network and the size of the work group. So it's basically something that Cisco is actively recommending.
What Cisco hardware is, or what hardware platforms is Cisco planning to put Lisp into? I mean, you mentioned ASR and Nexus 7K. What about some of the legacy stuff like 6500 and the other Catalyst switches?
Okay, so the 6500 and the 4500 are roadmapped. It's going to take some time because even though it will be on those chassis, the ASICs that actually do the encapsulation are new ASICs. So those are going to be basically in the mid to late 2012 timeframe, and it will require the next generation of hardware on those platforms. So on the Catalyst 6500, it would be basically what we call the Soup 2Ts, I believe. That's basically their next generation of hardware that uses the same chipset as the Nexus 7000 today. And then a similar story on the Catalyst 4500. There'll be Lisp support on their next generation of K processors, right? So that's very much in there. We're looking also at the larger platforms. ASR 9000s and CRSs are also undergoing their scheduling process to actually get the functionality there. And as far as data center platforms is concerned, it's mainly the Nexus 7000 at this point. As I mentioned, we do have a prototype on the Nexus 1000V, but it's not targeted for productization at this point. So that covers most of the product line, really.
Did you say the ISR G2s as well, the X900s?
Yes, all the ISRs, G2s and all generations. So if you have an all generation ISR, you can actually load the code and turn on Lisp on those ISRs today.
Gotcha. So, Victor, we got a pretty good idea of the Cisco hardware that's going to support this. I had one more listener question that had come in, which is Lisp in its current state or any of its future developments going to be ready to handle a dynamic environment? And specifically what he's asking is an environment where VMs or users move a whole lot. They move from one point to the other very frequently. And he says he's been looking at the different database options, and he's not really convinced that they're going to be able to handle situations like that. Would you comment on that?
Sure. So different environments will behave differently, meaning depending on how many of these you have moving frequently, you will have a bigger hit or a smaller hit on the database, right? That will cause that would be most of the churn. So if you think about it in terms of what would it take to do this in the network versus what would it take to do it with Lisp, I think with Lisp we have a much better shot at actually managing that churn in a much more effective way and at larger volumes, right? If you were to do host routing to do this, or basically do moves in a layer two environment, you'd be looking at basically churning your tables across the board all of the time. What we're saying is with Lisp, your tables stay stable, and all we're churning is that mapping database. And the tests that we've run so far, we can actually handle a fairly decent amount of requests per second, in the order of tens of thousands. And that's only on one node, right? The processing of the mapping updates is really minimal, and that's how we can actually get to those large numbers. And that is basically in an environment where the environment has, say, 50,000 of these devices moving around, right? And that could be considered a good sized data center, and yeah.
Cloud data center too.
Cloud data center, right? so we think it's ready for that. Now we did design this for the internet, and I think where the question may be coming from is those deployments on the internet level are not just about one mapping server node, but you have multiple nodes that are interconnected in different ways, right? Right now, one of the proposals that's on the table is to use what we call an alternate topology, which actually uses BGP to interconnect those different mapping server nodes, right? At that point, there is no churn that get turned into BGP, because you will always, regardless of where you move, you will always register with the same node. What that means is that node is always advertising the same thing over BGP, regardless of the churn that it may be experiencing. So again, even in that model, the churn is contained to a node. So if we dimension our nodes appropriately, right, to handle the number of prefixes or host routes, if we go that granular, If we dimension those nodes correctly, I think we're in good shape. And keep in mind that CPU power is getting extremely, extremely large at very low costs, right? So that's another factor to keep in consideration there when we're trying to handle this control plane churn.
Yeah, so between having a lot of CPU and proper design, you're saying this isn't going to be an issue. Dynamic environments are going to be fine.
Yes. Yeah. That's why we're banking so heavily on it. Yeah.
That's true. I mean, Cisco has committed a lot of resources and a lot of press to this and has been talking about it for some time, which shows a level of commitment that perhaps we haven't seen around other standards over time. So, you know, I'd back that statement if that's any...
Excellent.
Worth anything to anybody. So there's an RFC that was published called RFC 6115, which talks about a routing research group which looked at Lisp and its alternatives, and it fundamentally as an RFC, and it's just for informational. It talks about the fact that several other technologies were considered as alternatives to Lisp, and it lays them all out. In fact, it was actually written by T. Lee from Cisco Systems,
yeah,
and he
Tony.
Explains all the other different options, you know, nulls and compact routing and layered mapping systems, and the fact that at the end of the day, this research group wasn't able to converge on Lisp as a proposed solution, which sort of suggested to me at the time that the path to Lisp wasn't necessarily the only option. There are other options that other vendors may pursue. Would you like to sort of say, I mean, we've obviously seen that you're saying that Cisco is committed down the Lisp path. Do you think there's going to be more than one solution to solve this problem, or is this going to be the one that people would converge on?
Well, so I think there's always going to be different opinions, right, on the effectiveness of one mechanism or another. Now, if you look at the different options that were analyzed in Tony's document, right, one of the main ones was NLP, and that is also trying to achieve some level of separation. I think even though there isn't convergence on the exact implementation and architecture to be used, I think there is some level of convergence into what conceptually needs to change on the internet in terms of addressing and handling of that addressing in a different way, in an evolved way. So I think this RFC is a proof of a healthy environment of you know, debate and discussion of ideas. Now, as far as commitments, Cisco has to pick an option, right? And the choice has been Lisp. And we're going to give that our best try. And we have support across the board, all the way from our CEO down to our guys that are doing the coding. And everybody's basically on board with this, and you will see that it's across the product line, which is something that that takes a lot of work to do at Cisco. We have the alignment and the acknowledgement to actually go across the product line. So we're putting all our weight behind it. There are of course other options, but this is the one that we are pursuing in the immediate term. And we have reason to think that this is actually going to work well. So, yeah.
Right. That's good, because I'd written previously about it. There's a blog post on my website, which I'll link to in the show notes, and as well to the RFC, so that you can read that and make your own decisions.
Absolutely. And when you read through this, one thing that I would say is always keep in mind that there are some views of all of the internet that that tend to assume that IPv6 is a reality in the short term, and it's broadly deployed. And we chose not to assume that V6 would be there before we can solve this problem, right? So you'll see a lot of these mechanisms actually rely on an expanded address space, which is what V6 provides, and then leveraging that expanded address space to do something very similar to what we're doing.
Okay.
What we're saying is that may not happen anytime soon in a pervasive manner, right? Pervasive enough for us to actually address the problems.
Right. So, I just thought I'd flag that up in a sense that there has been quite a bit of industry work done on various technologies and solutions, and but Lisp has been talked about extensively at Cisco, and I think it's been at Cisco Live for a few years now. I think even you've been presenting, if I remember rightly, for a couple of years on it.
Dino's presented it. Greg's presented it. I've been in some panels. There are presentations coming up at Cisco Live. There's about 8 or 10 different presentations on Lisp. I own a couple of them. So we're very active in that front, evangelizing. We're very active coding it, and it is a live project within Cisco. It's left the drawing board a long time ago. It's actually.
And as you say, there are actually live data centers that are actually using it.
Yes. So we have our series of early field trials. We have now some deployments that are production deployments, and we also have the large number of pilot sites that are using this.
Right. One last question that I should have asked up front. Security. Has security been built into this? Are we going to have authenticated agents and nodes and ingress tunnel routers and egress tunnel routers? Are they all going to be secured away? Yeah. So that's all part of the standard.
So today what we have is a very simple shared key mechanism, similar to what you would have in a traditional routing protocol. But we also have what we call LispSec. SEC, which is basically our RFC that defines exactly how we're going to do control plane encryption and security. Right, so it gets even tighter as we move forward. That hasn't been implemented in the current shipping software, but it's scheduled to be implemented in the next two releases. So they have.
So big shout out all to the security people there. It's actually being thought of. It may not be here today, but it is part of the long-term plan.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it there and say that's it for the show this week. And thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Victor, thanks very much for joining us and taking time to talk to us about Lisp.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're going to be doing anything exciting this week? Getting ready for live, I guess.
Getting ready for life, and I'm actually running. I set a goal to run a triathlon before I turned 40, and that's happening on Sunday. Then I'm getting on a plane to go to life. So it's kind of exciting.
Excellent planning there. Yeah. Well, good luck with that. I'll be. Have you got a Twitter account or something where people can follow you?
I don't, but I might set one up.
No, don't. You won't get anything done. You'll be attention deficit like us.
Right.
If you've got any questions for Victor, then people can go and leave comments on the blog posts, and I'll either get them to Victor or point them out and ask him to answer those on the blog post. And Ethan, what are you going to be up to for the week ahead?
Hammering away on my projects, and I'm going to try to blog some more. I wanted to do one on lists today, and I've got some other follow-up blog posts that I owe at packetattack.org, and of course I'll be tweeting at EC Banks on Twitter, although I must admit Google Plus has really captured my attention, and I can't say I'm leaving Twitter, but man, Google Plus is way cool. So when it gets opened up and everybody can get on there, I think it's going to be a good time for the nerds.
And I'm Greg Ferrer. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com or on the Twitter at etherealmind. But just like Ethan, I'll be spending far more time on Google+. From time to time, I am randomly hanging out, which for those of you who have a Google Plus account means you can video to me. And I'd be more than pleased to say hello. I had some fantastic discussions this week with Sagun Daini from Nigeria. Big shout out to you. And also Ziad Bashir in Saudi Arabia, which was just fascinating. I know you guys have been great supporters of the show, so thanks for taking the time to chat to me over the video. Remember that we would love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. Check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net. Leave comments, hurl abuse, or send us love letters. We enjoy them all. Twitter at packetpushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.